So I well, we started last episode talking about trailers. So, I mean, why not continue that? Because there's been a couple of new trailers dropped since the last time we talked. And that is, well, the first one, probably the most exciting one, is Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. Long name. You were saying not a good name.
No, it's not. Like, all the Mission Impossible titles have really dumb subtitles.
Yeah. I would be a lot happier if they just numbered the movies. And
yeah, but then that gets a little unwieldy.
Yeah.
Because I don't even know what we're at. Like, Mission Impossible 7?
7.
So, I mean, it's catching up to Fast and Furious pretty quickly.
Yeah. At least that, like, they were numbering them all the way up through 3, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
But, like, they're not really connected to each other that much, are they? They're kind of standalone films.
That's kind of one thing I like about them. They're not too obsessed with lore, and I mean, we're about to talk about a movie that is, like, completely swimming in lore.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's some big problems with that.
But did you like the trailer? I love the trailer.
The trailer was exciting. I mean, it felt like a work in progress, though. Like, they didn't really have a lot of the individual sequences put together yet. They were just kind of like flashing. Like,
but that's all you need.
That's I mean, you know what to expect from Mission Impossible at this point, and all you wanted to see was, like, all right, are we going to get Tom Cruise running? We do. Are you going to get a couple of glimpses of the really big stunts? We do. They run a train off a bridge in the style of like, what was the famous silent film? The General with Harold Lloyd, I think. Not Harold Lloyd. Buster Keaton.
Know. Okay.
Yeah, that seems like a reference. Knowing Tom Cruise, that's a reference to The General, probably, because he claims to be a huge cinema buff.
Okay, could be possible. But, I mean, we saw all the main characters and all the new ones that are coming in.
Yep, yeah, we got a bit of Hayley Atwell being raced around some European city in a tiny car.
Yeah, there's always some brunette female lead in his films. he's got a type for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, between that and Top Gun, he's going to have a hell of a summer. Although Mission Impossible doesn't come out for, like, another year, does it?
Yeah, exactly. Because they're very clear, like, next year this is coming out. So,
but you know what? I hate trailers these days because they show off too much of the plot.
Yeah.
So I'm just happy that all we saw were stunts and things flying around. And that's all you need to do to sell me on a Tom Cruise movie. Like, we were talking earlier today, if the movie was called Tom Cruise Action Film, I'd still buy a ticket.
Yeah. Good. Well, and that's it. That sets it in contrast to the other big trailer from the past couple of days, which is for Thor: Love and Thunder.
Yes.
Because that's an example of a trailer that kind of lays way too much on the table. Like, you do see a lot more than we did in the teaser, but I felt like I got a pretty, like, clear arc of what we're going to see. You know, all the major scenes, you got the villain, you figure out what he wants. You're going to see, like, you know, there's going to be some conflict between Chris Hemsworth and Natalie Portman.
Yeah, there's a villain arc, there's a main character arc, there's a love interest arc.
Yeah, the whole thing is in the trailer, so.
Yeah, exactly. Although, I mean, Christian Bale, I'm really interested to see what he does as the villain, because it looks like he's kind of hamming it up, which I really like.
Yeah.
I like the cinematography where, like, Thor's world is very colorful, and then you go to Christian Bale. I think his name's, the character he plays is Garf or Gorf or something like that.
Yeah, but he's
like a throaty sound, like something makes you want to throw up. But I like how his world is more monochrome, more black and white.
Yeah.
I still think Natalie Portman is a very uninteresting actress sometimes.
But you're supposed to be excited that she gets to be in the action this time, and she's not just sort of wandering around being like, I'm a physicist.
I guess. But you know Chris Hemsworth's going to steal the show.
Yeah.
Because at least, like, he's a meathead, but he's a funny meathead.
Yeah, he's been way more funny in the more recent outings in the role. So, and he's really leaning into it here. And there's even some people, like, theorizing that maybe he'll get in, like, he'll start dating Star-Lord or something.
Well, there is definitely some sexual tension there.
Yeah, but it's backed up by the comics, I think. There's something about Star-Lord being, like, bisexual or something.
Well, I mean, he does have a thing for aliens, so I don't imagine, like, a male appendage is that strange to him.
Exactly. I don't think Marvel will go too far down that route because obviously they...
Well, because it can't show in China.
even the American cut doesn't get like any kind... And they never have any real like sex or romance in any movies that they make anyway, so...
Yeah, true. I mean, the last time we had a sex scene in a Marvel movie in that terrible, boring one, what was it called?
I don't know. There's like five or six movies that fall under that.
The most recent one, not the Barry Keoghan one, the one. Oh, with Eternals. Snow. Yeah, Eternals. There was a sex scene in that one. Remember?
Yes.
And it was awkward as hell.
Yeah. And there was a big outburst of people on Twitter being like, "We don't need sex scenes in movies."
Well, I mean, just has to be done right. That one was just kind of awkward and
yeah,
weird.
Yeah.
But we also saw a different kind of awkward and weird movie today.
Yeah. So coming up after the intro, so we have to actually get the show started for real.
Yeah.
Coming up after the intro, we're going to talk about Fantastic Beasts. So you want to get started?
Yes.
Welcome to the Extra Buttery Podcast. It's a show about movies, TV, anything with a story and actors on a screen, really. Join Jason Chan and Robert Snow's free-flowing conversation with deep dives into characters and plot with the occasional salty opinion. So get your popcorn. I got mine right here. Let's start the show!
Welcome to episode 109 of the Extra Buttery Podcast. This is Robert Snow coming to you from Vancouver.
Ooh.
And Jason Chen, my co-host, is also in Vancouver. That's right. We're in the same city for the maybe the second time. No, third time. I don't know.
Not enough times.
Yeah, we do this remotely, as most of you know, almost every episode. But rare times we're in the same city. We always try to get a podcast episode in. So
I could touch his arm right now.
Oh, tension. And if I say something he doesn't like, he can also slap me. So you never know.
Well, I'm no Will Smith. So,
oh, okay, good.
I'll politely warn you before I slap you. But you're not the person I want to slap today. The person I want to slap today is Albus Dumbledore. But
oh, okay.
But
yeah.
You want to set this one up, though?
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore. Otherwise known as Fantastic Beasts 3. We know this movie came out like a couple months ago, but we're in a weird kind of dead period in movies. And we were like, you know, we need to see something together to talk about on the show. So why not this?
Yeah, exactly. We need an excuse to do a live podcast because it's always, I find the dynamics a little different because feel your energy.
Yeah.
But also because next weekend is Memorial Day weekend, so that's the big movie release date in the U.S. But in Canada, there's no such thing because nobody cares about the Canadian market anyway.
Yeah,
unfortunately. So, but I thought it'd be like nice to see Fantastic Beasts because we'd have plenty to talk about.
The world as we know it is coming undone. If we're to defeat him, you'll have to trust me,
Mr. Kowalski. We need you.
I said I want an out, and I want out.
Ah! You do know I'm a witch, right?
Dumbledore asked that I give you something, Jacob.
This is the team that's going to take down the most dangerous wizard in the century. Who wouldn't like our chances?
It so far has not been critically or commercially well received.
No. In fact, it's the worst performing movie in the whole Harry Potter extended universe or whatever.
Oh, really?
The Wizarding World.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the writing was on the wall for this one back towards when the last one came out. What was that called? Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, which I guess came out like, I don't know.
Should be retitled Crimes of Johnny Depp.
Oh.
And then you have to walk that back because clearly things have changed quite a bit. But.
Yeah, he's got a whole army of supporters out there who are going to come after you. But so Johnny Depp is conspicuously absent from this film. Mm-hmm. They don't bother to address why his character is suddenly being played by Mads Mikkelsen. I guess we're supposed to know that Grindelwald is able to change his appearance.
Yeah, because we got the first Grindelwald, which was Colin Farrell.
Yeah,
Yeah. Right. So I kind of like how they got a different actor to play Grindelwald in each installment, I guess.
Yeah.
I do think that Mads Mikkelsen is a huge step up, though. Because I respect him more as an actor. I like his work a lot more than Johnny Depp.
Agreed. And he's definitely more menacing in general. Mm-hmm. Johnny Depp in the last film, all he really did was kind of what felt like a mishmash of all his pre-existing characters. Like, there was a bit of his Willy Wonka in there. There was a bit of Jack Sparrow.
Yeah, I was going to say, imagine a Jack Sparrow in a Harry Potter movie. I think that'd be a really, really funny mashup.
Yeah, but no. So yeah, Mads Mikkelsen is here. He's the evil Nazi Trump of the Wizarding World. It's still set in the early 20th century. And, you know, he's on the lam. He's got some dark wizards around him. He's this series' version of Voldemort. And we have a team of people assembled by none other than Albus Dumbledore trying to counter his plot to kill all of the non-magic users in the world, the Muggles. So you've got Albus Dumbledore played by Jude Law. There is Newt Scamander, who used to be the hero of these movies, played by Eddie Redmayne. We've got returning characters like Jacob Kowalski, like a Muggle that they hang out with for some reason. You've got Callum Turner as an Auror from England, who's also teamed up with them. An American witch who's like really good at defensive magic or something. I don't know. They just keep bringing more and more characters into this story.
I think just based on the way you described it shows you like how interesting the characters are.
Yes, yes.
I think of all those, I kind of like Theseus the best, which is the Callum character. So the other older brother of Newt Scamander, I believe.
Yes, yeah.
Because he just seems to be like the only one who's taking things seriously.
Yeah.
All the other ones kind of drift in and out. They're cracking jokes. Newt Scamander still drives me nuts because it often feels like he has a lack of urgency.
Yeah.
And and he's too quirky of a character to take seriously.
Yeah.
And the female leads don't get a lot to work with.
No.
It's subtitled called The Secrets of Dumbledore, but I don't know what exactly was the big secret in this one.
No. I mean, they talk about how the character played by Ezra Miller is supposed to be secretly a member of the Dumbledore family.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the last one, they said that he's Albus Dumbledore's brother. That had been like, you know, shipped away as a baby or something and disowned. And so he grew up to be like, you know, caustic and not, maladjusted. And he has this dark magic stuff in him that makes
neglected childhood.
Yeah, all that stuff. And in this one, it's revealed that he's not actually a brother to Albus. He's actually Albus Dumbledore's nephew. So which doesn't really change anything because Credence is barely in the movie.
Actually, you know, like, how much do you remember or know about the Dumbledore family lore from the Harry Potter books?
Some of the backstory. This is going back a long time. I haven't read, like, the books that talk the most about that from the original Harry Potter series were like the 6th and 7th ones.
Yes.
And it's been like over 10 years since
and
I
it's,
read those.
It's actually very interesting. The three siblings, so Ariana, Aberforth, and Albus.
Right.
Because they went through like a huge family tragedy.
Okay.
They had a huge falling out. And that wasn't very touched on in these movies, which I thought was disappointing because I thought that was what The Secrets of Dumbledore was referring to. If the secret was that Dumbledore was like a closet homosexual with Gellert Grindelwald, I don't think that was a big secret at all.
No, it seems like almost everyone knows and is okay with it.
Yeah, and it was always implied in the books that Albus Dumbledore was gay. And there's also a lot about wand lore, which is why like I was really pulled into the books in the first place, because J.K. Rowling had really put a lot of thought and care into this universe she's created. And perhaps for the sake of money, perhaps for the sake of just simply expanding the story because the studio asked her to, it does seem like she's not adding a lot, and she's also like confusing a lot of like information that we had previously known or learned.
Yeah, it seems like she's adding things, but she's adding pointless things.
Yeah, like it's meandering, and by the end of this movie, spoiler alert, but I don't think Albus Dumbledore and Gellert Grindelwald ever moved their relationship forward.
No.
Other than breaking that dumb bracelet that he wears.
Yeah.
Swearing that they can't kill each other.
They make a big deal in the beginning of the movie showing that this bracelet is around Dumbledore's wrist, and if he thinks about betraying Grindelwald or thinks about killing him, it'll like kill him instead.
Yeah.
And which is a fine concept. I think they talked about it in the last film too. But it never plays a role.
Yeah.
It's revealed at the end that all they have to do is just, you know.
It does feel like a movie that tries to pivot a lot, because a lot of stuff that they tried previously just didn't work.
Yeah.
So you had Newt as the main character in the first one, but people were kind of like, he's too quirky, I can't relate to him, we need a straight hero. And then they're like, well, who is the most interesting character in the Harry Potter universe? Albus Dumbledore. Mm. They introduce him, and then he becomes a main character, but he also becomes like the main infallible hero. There's a part in the movie where like he's basically implied to be like the purest of heart. But if you go back and read the books, this guy was a complete dick to Harry Potter. Like he had no regard for Harry Potter's safety.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of things and obscured a lot of things for his own personal gain or what he thought was the greater good without, you know, consulting everyone else. Like there's a bit of there's a lot of arrogance behind Albus Dumbledore.
Yes.
I didn't get that in this movie. It seemed like he was too collaborative. There was a part where like he explains what each person has to do without telling them why they have to do it, and they kind of follow him blindly. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll give him that. But the plan he came up with was super dumb.
Yeah, it was really
not complicated.
It was not complicated. I think at the beginning, he tells Theseus, Scamander, he's like, I need you to trust me so much that even when you think that everything tells you to betray me, I need you to still stick with me. And Theseus has never met with a single instance where that would be.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start from the top. So first of all,
We're getting really,
mixed. I know, like
we're getting, this movie is confusing enough that even our like initial analysis of it is scattered.
Well, cause it's like, it's really tempting to just dive right into like the whole bigger, broader universe.
Yeah.
Right. But the movie starts with like 20 minutes of like darkness. Like I told you right after the movie, I was like, I wish someone had a brightness setting and turned it way up, because I couldn't see a single thing. I was falling asleep. Everyone's wearing like, it looked like industrial London. I think that's where it was set.
Yeah.
And so everything was like gray cobblestone. There's a plot point about Phoenix ashes.
Briefly.
And then just everyone's wearing like dark wool, and it was hard to tell what was going on. And if you think back to the first movie with Fantastic Beasts, it was very colorful. You had all sorts of like bright, colorful creatures. The first creature we see in this one is shrouded in darkness. I had no idea what color it was until the very end.
Yeah. It has like a glowing, like it's this deer-like thing that's supposed to be able to tell people who is the most pure and who's the most evil.
With like a reptile-ish skin.
Yeah, but it has like a glowing thing inside it, which doesn't really serve any purpose. Yeah. It's just supposed to look magic-y.
Yeah, and then you're introduced like to the whole slew of characters, which is fine. There's one character, the female witch.
Oh,
Lani?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
Lally Hicks.
Okay.
And within like a span of 20 seconds, she like summarizes the whole plot from the first and second movie. And I thought that was really funny.
I was like, sort of spreading my hands in disbelief in the theater, because I'm like, why would she tell this information to this particular character? He knows all of this. This is such like a screenwriter trick to kind of catch the audience up to speed.
So this movie, we should mention, was written by J.K. Rowling and Steve Kloves, who have worked together. And I remember telling you too, I was like, this feels like a movie where two writers who don't have a cinematic bone in their body wrote the screenplay, because it was very much a stage play. It read like a book. It was like, person A did this, person B did this, and then they fight.
Yeah.
And then, so there's a lot of waiting around for other people to do stuff.
Yeah.
Wait, like actors waiting for their cue to deliver their line or for a plot point to go forward. So in that sense, it felt very disconnected and very disjointed.
Not
to mention that Catherine Waterston's character is in it for maybe 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And there's one scene in the climactic battle where they show a reaction shot of her, which was totally unnecessary, because you could have just saved it for the very end when she shows up for Jacob's wedding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just little things like that that just kind of irk me. And there's no standout scene, because once they introduce the characters, they do like a really slow job of introducing the multiple layers of the plot that actually also end up never going anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. They go through this whole trouble of like running a mission against Grindelwald that fails, and they literally find themselves all back at Hogwarts again.
Yeah,
and they say to Dumbledore, they're like, oh, we're back where we started. And then he says, no, actually everything's worse.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so what was the last half hour of the movie about?
Yeah. And there's like people who are traitors, but not really traitors.
Yeah.
Deception, but not really deception.
Dumbledore puts a guy in Grindelwald's like camp or in his mansion, yeah, wherever the hell he is in Switzerland, and the guy just sort of stands around and kind of observes, doesn't provide any information to Dumbledore that we know of. His only function seems to be in the climax to like knock some bad guys over with a spell.
It bugs me. It treats the characters and the audience so dumb.
Yeah.
You know,
I wonder too, like, how much of this was changed in response to test screenings, because I know that like when a movie is entering the final stages of editing, they will put cuts in front of test audiences, and then they will have the audiences fill out questionnaires that literally ask them like, what was your connection to this particular character? What did you think about this part of the story? And depending on what answers they get back, they will literally change the movie in response. So this sort of feels like a movie that was focus grouped to death, where they, you know, they had storylines going one direction, but then in response to this audience feedback, they literally changed it. And so we end up with like,
yeah, I mean, that's fair, because they imply a tension between Aberforth and Albus, which is fleshed out quite a bit in the books. And it's a very interesting sibling rivalry slash relationship. But they don't really go anywhere with it. They're kind of speaking whispers in dark corners of the room.
Yeah.
But they're not really talking about anything. It's just they're talking about things that other characters can overhear and move the plot forward.
Yeah.
And that just kind of bugged me. Newt and his assistant, I don't know what the relationship was there, but she was key to the plot, and she kind of disappears for three quarters of the movie.
The screen editors are hoping you forget about her.
Yeah, I mean, Theseus is the straight guy. He doesn't really have much conflict of his own.
No.
He kind of tags along for the ride. I don't know. There wasn't an interesting part of the movie other than maybe the creatures.
Yeah, because, I mean, the Fantastic Beasts series has always been like, here are some kind of adoring sequences of these crazy looking creatures. I feel like those get fewer and fewer as the series goes along. And
you know what they should do?
What?
They should spin off the franchise with just the CGI animals, like Minions.
Like,
like, forget about Gru, forget about Dumbledore. Just have the Minions and the Fantastic Beasts.
Make it like Planet Earth.
Exactly. Like the little stick dude.
Yeah.
Like, I would watch him for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
By the way, this movie is 2.5 hours. It should not be that long.
No.
At all.
Oh, my God. It should be like an hour 45.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, like I would sooner watch a like half hour episodes where it's just Eddie Redmayne telling you facts about these magical animals.
Yeah, I know.
While you watch them like play around with
each other. Yeah, it should be like an ABC PBS educational show, you know?
Well, the whole idea of the first movie in this series was that they were going to like build something off of the little paperbound bonus book that you could buy as a Harry Potter fan that was supposed to be your copy of Newt Scamander's Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And the whole selling point of that little spin-off book was just flipping through the pages, reading these short descriptions of these magical animals and what they do and, you know, where they're found. And it was like, that was thin on its own, but it was just a little, you know, Easter egg
thing. Yeah.
And now I feel like they get less and less to work with the more they kind of drag that out. And they should just really go back to the original idea, you know?
Even Jacob Kowalski, who I thought was one of the better characters in the first two movies, because he was actually kind of funny. Even in this one, I didn't find him that amusing. He kind of goes along with the ride. You know he's going to be like
an everyman.
Like an everyman, an unwitting hero.
Yep.
His love story with Queenie, she kind of takes a heel turn in the second movie. She's brainwashed or something. I can't remember, recall.
Yeah, I don't remember
remember at all.
Why she tosses her lot in with Grindelwald.
Yeah. And then in the third movie, all of a sudden she turns good again because it's convenient. I didn't quite get that
Did you get the sense that they were trying to kind of tie off certain story threads here? Because
was supposed to be a 5-movie series, right?
Yeah, but did you sense that, like, in the middle of production, they kind of sensed that this was going to die? And so they...
For sure.
Yeah.
100%. They knew this was going to bomb before they released it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why they killed it off, like, before they finished the 5 movies. And even though the ending's still open-ended, I think they left it open enough to be like, okay, well, you can draw the obvious conclusion here that Albus Dumbledore is victorious and Gellert Grindelwald, like, dies or whatever happens to him.
I seem to remember there was a flashback sequence in, like, one of the two parts of movie 7 where they show Grindelwald being defeated.
Do they?
Because there's something to do with how he is the owner of the Elder Wand.
Yeah.
And then he has to be defeated in order for somebody to take it from him. So the Elder Wand passes from Grindelwald to Dumbledore.
Yep.
And then Voldemort takes it. And then Harry becomes the owner of it.
No, Draco Malfoy does.
Oh, okay. Yeah. See, I've already.
No, but that's a plot point that everyone kind of forgets. But it also, to me, is like one of the best parts about Harry Potter, about how detailed this can get and like the misdirection it plays. There's no real misdirection here.
No.
There's a parlor trick where they switch up the briefcases.
Yeah.
But honestly, what good is magic if you can't tell right away which one is the magical briefcase? Yeah. Like, come on, dude.
Yeah. And like, then, isn't there like x-ray spells or something?
And the fact that this really bothered me, because there's two real like battles. So one is in the Great Hall, where Gellert kind of like reintroduces himself to the public and reveals that he's running for this, I don't know, this
world president
title, whatever it was.
I don't even remember that being a thing. Yeah,
it doesn't matter. So there's that one, and then there's a staged assassination attempt, but not really. And the second one at the castle in Bhutan, there's another similar like battle, but at the same time, I'm also thinking, like, there's just a lot of people just standing around kind of watching this happen, like, doing nothing.
Yeah.
And the witch, presumably from India, who gets elected as, like, world president of the magical world, whatever, we do not get to hear her speak. We do not know anything about her.
Nope.
All we ever get is that we know the magical creature Chilin bows to her, and we know her heart is pure.
Yeah.
But only after the Chilin or Qiling, like, it's supposed to be like based on Chinese mythical creatures, bows to Albus Dumbledore.
Right.
Which I had, that was, I think, my biggest issue with that movie. Really? Albus Dumbledore is not pure of heart.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he,
I think it just flies in the face of all the lore and the world that J.K. Rowling had created. Dumbledore, I think, is a very interesting example, because when the movies were first released, people are like, oh, this guy's like a mentor. He's a teacher. He's great. He's shown Harry the ropes. But in recent years, we've kind of come to the realization that he's not such a great guy.
Yeah.
And J.K. Rowling made a point of saying that as well. So now you're back to the point where he is pure of heart. I don't get it.
I can't keep up with it. Isn't there a whole part in the very beginning of this film where he and Grindelwald sit down for tea together and they talk about how Dumbledore was briefly interested in...
I forgot about that scene completely.
Yeah. He talks with Grindelwald about how he was briefly interested in following Grindelwald's lead and like getting rid of Muggles because he was in love with Grindelwald.
Yeah.
And I'm like...
Which is just a dumb conversation. Sorry.
Yeah.
How is the most powerful wizard in the world like falling into this logical fallacy because he's blinded by love?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like... To me, whenever you can have the villain and hero sitting across each other and have a conversation about why they do or like the reasons why they do what they do.
Yeah.
I think it's always a very interesting conversation.
Yes.
And it brings me back to Heat, where like De Niro and Pacino are sitting across from each other, kind of explaining to each other how they're opposed on opposing sides and they respect each other.
Yes.
And it should be the same thing here. But we don't get that depth of conversation. Like, Pacino and De Niro has no personal relationship like Grindelwald and Dumbledore.
Yeah.
Like, there's a love story there. And we kind of don't really go anywhere. Like, who is the jilted lover here? Is it Dumbledore?
Yeah.
Is it Grindelwald? Like, what exactly happened? Like, does one person like the left side of the bed and the other one likes that left side too, and they get into a fight? And like, what exactly, you know, other than, you know, the whole pure blood thing?
Yeah, it's like, hey, I really want to sleep on the left side of the bed, also I need to kill millions of people.
Yeah.
Oh that was a red flag.
Yeah like, how are there no other red flags before that? Like, how could you be so thick?
Well, all of that to say that the, you know, the alleged romantic relationship between Dumbledore and Grindelwald never really makes any sense. You could argue that Rowling has always been bad at that, because when she initially...
Right, the hot Ron, Harry, Hermione.
That on its own, but also when she originally revealed that Dumbledore was gay, it wasn't really done in the context of a book, if I remember correctly.
No, someone asked that question.
Yeah, and she was like, oh, I've decided that he is.
Yeah,
and
everyone, yeah, that was on a whim.
A lot of the fans were kind of caught off guard by it. I mean, most of them were okay with the decision in principle, but it was just that, you know, she seemed to be retroactively adjusting adjusting the characters to suit whatever she wanted to say about them.
And maybe that was the first slip up, like the slippery slope that she never recovered from.
Yeah.
Where she said something in public and had to commit to it.
Yeah.
Even though maybe she kind of was, you know, just contemplating that aspect of Dumbledore's life.
Yeah. But she spent a lot of her career since the real height of the Harry Potter popularity really kind of like jealously defending her creation and, you know, going after people who she perceives as like not being fully on board with her vision of.
But do we blame her for that? I don't.
I mean, it's her creation, you know, she's made her very wealthy. I don't begrudge her that. Yeah. It's just, you know, I think if you're going to build one of these sort of cinematic universes, as it were, I think there is something to be learned from Marvel's way of doing things, where they have a overarching story, but then they let other people in to kind of adapt things out. Star Wars almost did that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're going to have to walk back a lot of the Rian Johnson stuff. Yeah. So I was going to say, this is kind of like the George R.R. Martin, where you create this world, you create rules, and then the public catches on. But the public is very smart. I mean, they'll come up with things that are very logical, and plot points that are very logical that maybe the author begrudgingly has to admit is very logical, but just refuses to go with it because it's not their creation.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when the Harry Potter series was done, a lot of the fans were like, well, you know what? Hermione and Harry should have been together, not Ron and Hermione. Yeah. And I think that was another one where J.K. Rowling was like, yeah, I think I made a mistake with that one too. And I think the public was right. I think Harry and Hermione were probably a better match. And J.K. Rowling had to kind of eat her own words. And I, like, for something that is so precious to her, like, gave her all sorts of fame and money, she must be very protective of it.
Yeah.
So I don't blame her for that. I just blame her for writing a horrible screenplay.
Yeah. And, well, obviously there are things in her public life that...
Yeah, that's like besides
the that's point. That's beside like, the like, point. I mean,
we're just talking about the movie.
Exactly.
I don't know how to say it. Like, the plot moves from one point to the next, fine. But it's just disjointed. Like, the action, the dialogue, the way it's edited. There's one scene where there's two different angles of Mads Mikkelsen's face, of the reaction shot when, like, the phoenix flies over his head, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's a part where, like, the ash lands on his face, and then next scene, the ash is gone.
Oh.
I don't know if you noticed that.
No.
Okay. Well, it seems like you said, it's probably just edited differently in its original version.
Yeah.
And then the theatrical version, they had to make changes.
Yeah.
And
they didn't have that shot of him without the ash
or whatever.
No,
I guess not. But yeah. I guess you could have CGI'd in, but whatever. It's too bad, because I think they did some things quite well. Like, the whole production design is very good. Like, other than the first 20 minutes being really dark, I know.
Yeah.
But that's a David Yates thing. I didn't like the later Harry Potter movies because they were really dark.
Yeah.
It's difficult to see what was going on.
They're
sometimes.
Like, people won't believe us that it's like a global crisis unless everything is the shades of gray.
Yeah, and it just kind of gets depressing sometimes.
Yeah, and the other thing that really got me about this movie is just the weightlessness of all the effects. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you go to a Wizarding World movie, as they like to brand them, to see the magic stuff happen.
Yeah,
you know, and it felt like, especially in this movie, nothing really mattered, nothing landed, because like duels would happen in these kind of mirror universes that
I didn't get that.
You know, it was kind of intended so that no random bystanders or property would get hurt, but all that did is kind of remove all the stakes and make it so like, okay, nothing we see really matters. It's all just sort of like magic.
They never really explained that though, right?
No. I think this was the first time we really saw it in any great, you know, detail, but it was everywhere. Like the battle between Dumbledore and Credence was, you know, at first you're like, oh my God, Credence is tearing up the streets of Brooklyn or wherever the hell they are and ripping things up, smashing through trolleys, like clearly killing dozens of people in the process. And then Dumbledore like snaps his fingers and then it's revealed that none of it is really happening. And I'm like, okay, so I just shouldn't care about any of that then, you know, same thing with the final,
remember this,
the final battle between Dumbledore and Grindelwald was the same way, where they slip into the side universe. Everyone else is busy focusing on the chillin bowing to the lady. Yeah. And meanwhile, Dumbledore and Grindelwald are having this mega duel in the background. No one notices. It's all happening in this kind of brightly lit empty world, and then they reach a stalemate and nothing happens again.
Can I also just point out like a huge logical flaw by giving the animal such power? Imagine if we like name presidents of the worlds by using
groundhogs.
Yeah. Or I was gonna say baby squirrels. Like, could you imagine?
Yeah, seems like you know, they've just all decided, oh, these creatures have the ability to tell good from evil.
I was like, really? What if I gave this creature like a really yummy snack? I bet you would pick me. Yeah. I'm sure these animals can be easily bribed or manipulated. And they made a big deal about how there were like two chillins that were born. And then so the one that Gellert Grindelwald used to pick him was bewitched and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I was thinking to myself, when the second one, the living one, showed up, if you were Gellert Grindelwald, wouldn't you just like on the spot be like, fake, and then just kill it right away?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He does.
Like he waits for it to make its pick. Not only make its pick, make its two picks.
Yes. He just sits there and watches. And you would think that like, you know, he'd been just elected by the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very respectful of this bizarre election process that they follow.
And his lackeys who like rig the vote, quote unquote vote, because it's not really a vote. I mean, it's basically authoritarian to this one creature. Nothing happens to these lackeys.
No, it's
really odd to me.
Even though they're allowed to like run around in public spaces, like knocking people out or killing them. Yeah, there's no repercussions.
And speaking to your magic, just going back. So, like, remember in the Harry Potter series where we go to Molly Weasley's house, and inside the house there's all sorts of magic happening. Like, the dishes are doing themselves, the food is cooking by itself. But you go to Aberforth's bar, and he's presumably one of the best wizards in the world. He's hand wiping down mirrors and bars.
Yeah.
And he's hand cooking everything. There's no, like, brooms in the background sweeping itself. Everything that's done manually. I'm like, dude, this guy like magical or what?
Yeah, that's because they wasted all of the CGI budget on the other stuff. They were like,
was it that big? I can't imagine the CGI was that, you know.
I mean, they definitely spent a lot of money on it. I think what this film cost, like at least 100 million.
Well, I'm sure marketing was part of it.
Yeah,
but like whenever the wands cross streams, I just kind of laugh because it looks so funny.
With all the foam coming out?
Yeah, all the foam and the bubbles. Yeah. And then when they're like shooting like blue fireballs out of it or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm always like, what spell is that exactly? Because we only get one. We know the green one's the death spell.
Yes.
Because that's in lore. And we know the Crucio is
the red one.
It's the one that tortures people.
Yes.
So that's what the one they use on Jacob. So we know those. But the other ones are like, okay, it's kind of like the superhero thing where we don't know which spell is more powerful than the other.
Yes.
We don't know which character is more powerful than the other. There's a difference in power dynamic for sure. I just don't know how it works.
Yeah. There is one scene, I think the most effective scene where there's any dueling happening is when Theseus and Professor Hicks are dueling against a bunch of Grindelwald's people.
Mm.
And they're...
They make things fly around.
Yeah. And it's shot in the style of like a Western. So you have all the townspeople kind of scurry away and they hide behind the shutters. And then they have like, you know, bad guys are up on the rooftops and in the balconies. And then so they're shooting spells back and forth and everyone's falling down. That was like reasonably well done. But yeah, to your point, you don't know what spells they're doing because they.
It just seems like every spell they throw, it's like people are pushed.
Yeah.
Or they fall over.
Yeah, a little punch on the chin.
Yeah, like. Really, you need a wand to do that?
Yeah.
I mean, if I had a wand and I could conjure up magic tricks, I'd be like, waterfall, wash you away.
Yeah.
Or like, turn you into glass and kick you and turn you, blast you into a billion pieces or something like that. The one trick, funny trick was that he got put one of the lackeys stuck in a wall.
Yes.
That was the only one that was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that was like visually interesting.
It's like, hey, it's not lethal. But it works.
Although you have to wonder what it's like to be stuck in into.
Well, I'm sure it's not pleasant, but he's a bad guy. Who cares? But yeah, overall, I didn't enjoy this film. Although I have to say, I think I enjoyed this more than the second one.
Yeah, the second one got really bogged down in like if you thought this film got bogged down in exposition, the second one was way worse. I vividly remember.
Way darker too, visually. I think.
Yeah. I vividly remember this scene where like a bunch of the hero characters who had just been like at odds minutes before decide to sit down when they're supposed to be rushing off to the climax to talk about wizarding family trees, which is a classic Rowling thing. Like her writing always has this vibe of like somebody who like knows the lore inside and out because she's the one who's creating it. And she's got you seated down and she's like, oh, and this happens. And then this happens. And this guy was related to this guy. And this is this and that and that. And I'm like, let me go read the wiki afterwards to get the context. Just tell me why I should care about these characters now, because what they're doing is lacking all urgency.
Yeah, so that again goes back to the screenplay thing where she wrote it like a book or a stage play where one person does this and then this person reacts and there's no like choreography. There's no instantaneous reaction to any of the stuff that's going on.
And people just don't react to things in a natural way. Like I know we're living in a magical world, but you know, you would think that in some of these sequences, there'd be a bit more chaos. There'd be a bit more like people kind of responding to things in a more like, I don't know, dynamic way. You know, they would be like, oh, wow, that person just got knocked out in front of me. Maybe I'll like run over then help them or like, you know, turn around and look at something. None of the background extras or anybody here ever seems to respond to anything that's going on around them.
It's like in the Deathly Hallows book, where the Reese Fons character sits them down and explains to them the wand lore.
Yeah.
Like you can sit down and read all that, with the three magical items or whatever it is. I can't remember. Was it Horcrux? Never. Anyway. You can do that in a book. You can't really do that in a movie.
Because it's something like, it's that classic like showing versus telling thing where you, if you're a book reader, you can go back and reread over something if you didn't really catch it the first time. You can go back up to the top of the page and be like, all right, okay, so, and then you absorb it, right? But you absorb information way differently when you watch something, and it, you know, it's, so it's got to be handled differently. So yeah, this, I mean, I don't expect many people are going to be listening to this podcast and be like, oh, wow, I have to rush out and see this now, because it's clear that like neither of us are super, are super positive.
Although,
on this.
I think it's always interesting to talk about why a film fails.
Mm-hmm.
When a film succeeds, you know why. Everyone knows why.
Yeah. It's that kind of feeling of like walking out of the movie theater and being like, wow, I had a great time.
But yeah. And also, but like some movies are good because they're flukes. But if they're bad, there's always a reason why it's bad.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put this film as bad. It's just very mediocre and uninteresting.
Yes.
It's just really not worth your 2.5 hours of time.
No. It's definitely, I remember writing about, I can't remember if it was the first or the second film, but it's, you would almost be better served as a Harry Potter fan to just go and read a bunch of the wiki articles, you know, and, you know, that is the same kind of rabbit hole that you get into reading the original Fantastic Beasts mini book, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're just like absorbing all of these facts about these animals, right? That's a more rewarding experience in this stuff because the characters are just not there.
I'm just glad we're done with this, but I don't think we're done with Wizarding World.
No, I mean, Warner Brothers is going to, you think they're going to let that IP slide?
No way. No way. I'm still waiting for a Harry Potter TV show or Harry Potter reboot.
Yeah.
Because we will get it at some point. And I think it deserves it because I did not like how the movie franchise ended.
There's something to be said for like starting over, maybe cutting out a lot of the chaff, kind of like getting to down to business a lot faster with some of this stuff now that they know where everything's going.
And I do remember certain parts of the book were changed for the film.
Yeah.
And Deathly Hallows should have not have been a two-part movie.
But then there is one other movie that I watched recently that we had thought about watching together, but now that I've seen it, I know that you would have hated me if we had seen this together, because it is...
I don't know if I would have hated you.
You would have been disappointed with me, I think. Temporarily. For a day. You would have been like, Rob,
but
why
it was,
did you...
It wasn't because of you, though.
No. But
it's the movie itself.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But you'd be like, why did you drag me to see this thing? It's so gory and grisly.
I know. I've just been like, Rob, I needed hours of therapy after that. I needed to go home and hug my baby Yoda stuffed animal for like a few hours.
Which, hey, we're looking at right now. So yeah. I can confirm, but it would be, if you were able to hug that thing, it might make you feel better about watching
it.
Oh, it
definitely does. But This is typical of Alex Garland. So tell me about this movie.
So this movie is called Men, which you said has already made a few people laugh when you told them
about
it.
Yeah, okay. So before we get into it, I've seen the trailer for this movie in theaters like two or three times.
Yep.
And no matter what movie I was in there to watch, when the title card revealed that the movie was called Men, it drew laughs. And not in like a ha-ha, oh, this is interesting. It was like, ha-ha, roll my eyes, look at this. Yeah.
Like, did you get the sense that people were sort of, they immediately assumed that the movie was some sort of feminist thing?
Yeah, some sort of feminist PC thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like a men-hating thing.
Right. Which, incidentally, it's not really, but...
Yeah. Like I said, it's a poorly titled movie for marketing purposes.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know where the title came into it in the development process, like if it was always going to be called that, or if that was done later. But either way, this is the third... feature film from Alex Garland, who people will know from Ex Machina and Annihilation. Mm-hmm. He also wrote, I believe he wrote Never Let Me Go.
The Gypsy movie.
The one with Andrew Garfield and Carey Mulligan, where they play, well, I won't tell you what they'll play.
But... Mulligan. Of course, I forgot the last name, but I got a mulligan on that one.
I don't know. I'm looking at him and I don't know what he's talking about here. But
mulligan? You don't know?
I know what it means in golf. But I don't know what it means in the context of this joke.
Well, I don't remember her last name. So
oh,
I got a mulligan.
Okay.
To
I thought it was, okay. It had a...
All dark. Right, sorry, bad joke.
I thought it was a sex thing.
Everything's a sex thing. No, it's not. Get your mind out of the gutter. Explain this movie.
Okay. So this is the thing I like about Alex Garland. He does original movies. It's always like a concept that is not based on a previous IP. And here we have the story of a woman played by Jessie Buckley, who's having a bit of a big year. She was nominated for an Oscar for a Netflix movie starring Olivia Colman. It came out last year sometime. And she's been popping up in more and more interesting projects. So here she's like the lead of this film. I think it may be, it's probably the biggest American film that she's led.
She reminds me a lot of Elizabeth Moss.
A little bit. She's less creepy than Elizabeth Moss, I would say.
Okay.
But she's playing a woman who has recently lost her husband. Her husband was, as seen in the movie, he's very unstable. She was planning to divorce him. And he commits suicide. He jumps off the building. And he makes sure that she sees him do it because he's very unstable. He wants to punish her. So she decides to...
Great guy.
Yeah, yeah. It's he's revealed to be a pretty messed up dude. But she decides, you know, in the wake of this death, she's going to take a... 2-week vacation in the English countryside, try to decompress. And when she gets out there, she discovers that this beautiful country house that she's staying in seems to be haunted by something.
You must wonder why you drove him to it.
Why? I didn't drive him to it.
I thought it'd be true. But if you had given him the chance to apologize, he'd still be alive.
Alex Garland has never been one much, contrary to J.K. Rowling, he doesn't like to overexplain things. He barely explains anything sometimes.
That's his biggest strength.
Yes. And I like that about his work. But the weirdest thing that Jessie Buckley's character experiences is that all of the men in this small village seem to be the same guy, just in different outfits. They're all played by Rory Kinnear, who people will recognize as M's second in command from the most recent Bond films. He served under the Judi Dench M, and he's also under the Ralph Fiennes one. So if you'll see him in those movies. And so here he pops up as like the affable guy who leases the cottage to Jesse Buckley. He plays the vicar of the local church. They do a bit of weird kind of like deep fakery on him, and they put his face on a school kid's head. So it's kind of like weirdly floating in the middle of the kid's face. And
so it's meant to look like a deep fake, like a bad deep fake.
I don't know. I mean, it's the movie doesn't have a huge budget, so I don't know if they wanted it to look better and couldn't, or if it was intended to look weird. Okay. But either way, it's a creepy effect. And Jesse Buckley's character feels like, you know, all of these men around her are just sort of encroaching on her, and she doesn't know exactly what she did wrong, what could possibly be leading to the way they're behaving around her. And she's just progressively more and more haunted and terrorized by all these people. And it's not clear exactly what they want from her either. Like, you assume that they want to like injure her, but when they get close to her, nothing really happens. It's always kind of like a, ooh, it's spooky, and then nothing happens. And ooh, it's spooky, and then nothing happens.
Typical Garland.
Yeah. So there's, thankfully, it's not a movie with a lot of jump scares. There is definitely some really like spine-tingling bits where, you know, one of the men played by Rory Kinnear is like fully naked and just wandering around outside the cottage, and Jesse Buckley doesn't know that he's there. And you just see him like peering in through the glass, and she's been like on a FaceTime call or something. And you're like, he's behind you, you know, that whole thing. Yeah. And you're, you know, so you're freaked out for her, but she doesn't realize it. And this just builds and builds, and she gets more and more of these strange encounters that she can't explain. She never really reacts to the fact that everyone has the same face.
Okay.
Which is a bit weird.
But does she, like, she's suspicious about it though?
Yeah. Right? She knows that it's, that something strange is happening, but she's not sure what. And it all builds to this climax. Like, one night she leaves the local pub where all of the guys inside all have this guy's face. And then one of the guys, the naked guy, shows up again. He's kind of like stuck a bunch of leaves into his skin, so he's bleeding all over the place, and he's got like twigs and things growing out of him, and he's fully naked. And he tries to get into the house by sticking his hand through the mail slot. She stabs the kitchen knife that she has into his forearm, and he just drags it back out. And then he's running around for the rest of the film with like two weird half arms on one side that he doesn't seem to like react to. So
basically, his arm has turned into cheese string.
Yes, but they seem to be able to like still.
That
like,
is so gross.
Yeah, and he's able to like grip things with it, and so he becomes more and more monstrous as time goes by.
Wait, how long does he survive with his cheese string hand?
Oh, like it seems like he could go infinitely because he's like he's not a human anymore for some reason.
Okay.
Then you know she. She gets away from him temporarily, and then he appears again, but he starts taking on the shape of the other men that she's seen prior to this encounter. And okay. Then he disappears again and pops up in the yard, and then starts becoming pregnant and giving birth to another full-sized human version of himself, again with a mangled arm, who then becomes instantly pregnant and gives birth, and you see everything. Like, there's no cutaways.
Okay, so how does he become pregnant? Like, his uterus or wherever it is just, like, gradually gets bigger?
Yeah, it gets instantly bigger. Like, he gets pregnant instantly.
And then bursts?
And, well, no, he, like, you know, he... there's a birth canal, and, like, a full-size man pops out of it. And
so it, like, crawls out.
Crawls out, and then that guy dies, and then... The guy who just was born then becomes pregnant instantly and then gives birth to another guy. And this happens like four or five times. And weirdly, Jesse Buckley's character is like horrified at first, as you would be. But as this keeps happening, she gets more and more bored by it. And the expression on your face is great, by the way.
I'm so confused.
Yeah.
Alec Garland watched Human Centipede on repeat or something?
I don't know. And it's so... What you're seeing in these scenes is like grisly and bloody, and you're like, I don't like it, I don't understand it, but it's not particularly scary. It's just gross. Okay. And I'll be damned if I know what it's about, because like we were just talking when we introduced the movie, like it's not, doesn't have a hit you over the head feminist message at all. Mm-hmm. Like it's not clear exactly what Garland is trying to say other than that bad things happen to people and that some dudes are bad.
So what happens to Jesse Buckley at the end of the movie?
It's kind of like an ambiguous ending. She sees all these guys getting born, and then, spoiler alert, the last human man that gets birthed from this monster or whatever, of the series of monsters, is seemingly a recreation of her dead husband, who comes out feet first. His feet come out of the last monster's mouth, and then he's born naked and he covered in blood. And then he sort of sits on the couch in the house and says something briefly to Jesse Buckley. And she's like, she seems kind of like over it. She's like, I figured it was you, you know, kind of thing. And then her friend comes to like save her because she'd called her for help. And all we see is like Jesse Buckley sitting on the steps out in the garden. And she's like seemingly fine. But there's blood everywhere on her, on the ground. Like, so it wasn't a dream.
Bizarre.
Yeah. And then it cuts to the title card, Men. And you're like, what?
Yeah. That doesn't appeal to me. Because at least with Ex Machina and Annihilation, there's like,
yeah,
there's a real theme to it.
Yes. And like the ending of Annihilation is amazing because it is so like hair tingling and creepy and
because it deals with death.
It deals with death, but rebirth and like acceptance of death.
Yeah, acceptance of death. That was the most interesting thing.
Yeah. And this doesn't seem to really say anything other than like, you know, some dudes are
Dudes are creepier than others.
Yeah.
Like, some dudes can give birth.
Yeah.
That is strange.
Yeah, I
don't know if I'm interested in watching this. I was kind of intrigued at first because I feel like this would have been like a really nice horror movie.
Yeah.
But now that you've explained how it actually works, I don't know if I'm into it.
Exactly. And I'm like, you know,
was this more gory than Suspiria or a similar level?
No, Suspiria is way worse. Suspiria has a climax where there's like dozens of people being mutilated and there's blood going everywhere. It's probably one of the bloodier things I've seen in the past few years. So
I'm so like impressed that you can withstand this kind of stuff.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I did not enjoy watching the Suspiria stuff. When that was happening, I was like, gross. Like, I don't want to watch it anymore. Like, I don't have any interest in seeing the movie again. I'm kind of proud of myself that I made it through. Okay. But
Northman, do you find that like fairly light levels of gore?
By comparison, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was okay with that because I was like, oh, yeah, Vikings are like,
they're brutal.
Brutal people and war is bad. Like, that violence almost felt justified.
Okay.
But enough. In Suspiria, it was just like, And to an extent, man, it was just like grisly images for the sake of it.
Yeah, like how can I make you disgusted and get a rise out of
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. I'm on board with like horror movies in general, as long as they're like artfully told and it doesn't feel cheap. Like, you know, it's a movie that is using the violence for a reason.
I will say the most scary horror movies I've ever seen were scary because of like the suspense, not the gore.
Yeah. And that's where Men is actually good. Like, before you see any of the really gory stuff near the end, it's the tension around what these men want from Jesse Buckley's character that makes them scary.
All right. Fair enough. Well, too bad.
Yeah.
We got two movies that we can't really recommend people see, but it was fun to, it's always fun to watch movies that are quote unquote bad because I think there's more to talk about. It was good seeing you in person.
Yeah, likewise. And I mean, if the timing had been better, it would have been nice to talk about Top Gun Maverick, but.
Oh, we will.
We will talk about it. That'll be the next episode for
sure. That's another one where we'll be like, this is great. That's it. That's the episode. It was great.
5 minutes. No, I'm looking forward to that. I want to see that on the biggest screen possible. Mm-hmm. Because that's
some movies have to be seen on the big screen.
Yeah, I think when the review embargo lifted on Twitter for that movie, you could tell because all of the film critics, all the pro critics, it was just like a succession of tweets being like, "This is incredible! This is fantastic!" Mm-hmm. Like everybody was in agreement that it was, well, you know, it is a spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, I like spectacle. So, yeah. But yeah, until the next episode. My name is Robert Snow in Vancouver.
And my name is Jason Chen in Vancouver. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
The Extra Buttery Podcast is written, recorded, and produced by Jason Chen and Robert Snow. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. And remember, popcorn is always better with extra butter.